From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Civilian casualties on the ground and from the air. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The U.S. military paid $20 million last year to compensate Iraqi civilians for injuries and deaths to family members. That's raised questions about the extent of civilian casualties at a time when ground troops are being charged with murder. But what about the so-called collateral damage when civilians are killed by bombs dropped from high-altitude aircraft? On To the Point, is there a double standard? Which civilian deaths are acceptable under the rules of war? When is prosecution required? On Reporter's Notebook later on, is the Voting Rights Act in danger? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. U.S. Marines are being prosecuted for murdering Iraqi civilians. Some ground troops complain they're held to a different standard than pilots who drop bombs from high-altitude aircraft. On To the Point, is there a double standard? When are civilian casualties acceptable under the rules of war? On Reporter's Notebook, a few Republicans have held up extension of a major civil rights institution. Are they trying to kill the Voting Rights Act? First, this news update. U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez today announced the arrest of seven men in Miami, accused of wanting to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago and FBI offices in Florida.
These individuals wish to wage a quote, full ground war against the United States. That quote is from the investigation of these individuals, who also allegedly stated the desire to, quote, kill all the devils we can. They hoped for their attacks to be, quote, just as good or greater than 9/11.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, the deputy director of the FBI, said the plot was more aspirational than operational. The U.S. attorney in Miami said the defendants were stopped before they had the capacity to carry out their threats. Bobby Block reports on Homeland Security for the Wall Street Journal. He's author of an upcoming book, Disaster, Hurricane Katrina and the Failure of Homeland Security. Bobby Block, always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Ben.
There have been news conferences in Washington, Miami, and Chicago, but it appears that these people never really had the power, the explosives or the equipment to really pose any danger.
No, I don't think they had anything other than the drive, and there's a certain question of whether it was their idea or whether it was suggested to them by the informants and undercover agents that infiltrated them.
They are accused of conspiring to work with al-Qaeda, but the closest they got to al-Qaeda was an FBI informant who claimed to be with al-Qaeda.
And not only that, he was the guy that apparently administered the oath of loyalty to Osama bin Laden. What we can't get from the Department of Justice or any federal agencies is an answer to the question of who brought up al-Qaeda, the group or the undercover agents. Right now, what we do know about them is they're a bizarre, if I am allowed to say that, sect, Muslim Christian sect, operating in a very poor area of Miami, Liberty City, and that they talked about launching attacks, and that their hopes seemed to be fostered by the federal government, who closed them down once it became clear that they were willing to keep taking things from the government. First, they took some boots, supposedly for their, quote, soldiers, and then they wanted money and guns, and that seemed to be the trigger to shut them down.
And they never got those things?
No, they didn't. And they didn't seem to have a coherent organization capable of carrying out a threat either. But this is the problem with this new so-called problem of homegrown terrorism. They range from groups like this to the Toronto cell, which we saw arrested and uncovered last week in Canada, which did seem to actually be looking to reach out to the remnants of al-Qaeda overseas, to lone wolves like the Mohammed Tahiri Azhar, who is accused of trying to run a group of college students down in Chapel Hill in March.
We're talking with Bobby Block, who's Homeland Security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. So it raises the question then of when do you step in? And I guess as well, given what the FBI informant was doing, claiming it was from al-Qaeda, How far do you go with that?
Right. And this is exactly the question that they're wrestling with themselves. If they are winning the war against Al-Qaeda, which they claim they are, the organization is being slowly destroyed and unraveled, then what you have is the idea, and then you have people selecting themselves to be terrorists. Well, how do you combat that? How do you fight an idea? How do you find people that are radicalized? How do you go out and do that? How do you create a net to be able to catch these people? And it does have implications for policing, for how you do this, and civil liberties, for sure. And they're aware of that, and they're wrestling with it.
Civil liberties, because at the moment at least, what we know is they were just thinking about doing something. They weren't actually doing it.
Right. And it also, you know, the other news that was broken in my newspaper today and also carried in the New York Times is the fact that, for instance, Treasury Department announced that it was using this program, this company, to look into bank transfers that were happening by normal people all over the world. And the response, of course, from a lot of people was one of outrage. But the police would argue and the FBI would argue that to be able to catch homegrown groups like this before they would operate, you need more of this. You have to have an aggressive and indeed invasive policing method that may not be compatible with our civil liberties.
It'll be very interesting to see how the trial goes forward, if in fact they plead innocent. At the moment, we don't know what they will do. And obviously, they're entitled to all of the protections that the law requires. Are there, do you think, a lot of these kinds of groups?
Look, it's impossible to know. I mean, some people are referring to this homegrown phenomena as the Pepsi Jihad, in the sense that it's a trend. It's attractive to certain disenfranchised groups. It has a certain cachet. Of course, these groups, even if they were equipped and successful, it would be unlikely that they would ever be able to carry out something grand and horrific like 9/11. However, the possibility of the kinds of attacks like we saw in London, where a guy makes a bomb out of hair dye,
takes a lot of people out. That kind of stuff
is possible.
Okay, Bobby Block, again, Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His book, Disaster, Hurricane Katrina and the Failure of Homeland Security. In a moment, civilian casualties on the ground and from the air on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Werman Ali back with To the Point. In 2004, the U.S. military paid families of Iraqi civilians $5 million in compensation for civilian injuries and deaths. Last year, that number quadrupled to $20 million. When the increase was reported by the Boston Globe, Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy said it served as a warning sign. Brian Bender reports for the Globe. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
How did you interpret the senator's statement? In what way is this a warning sign, this increase in compensation?
Well, because most or many of these payments are made to Iraqi families in the wake of military operations that have either killed or injured innocent bystanders in the crossfire, the increase, at least in Senator Kennedy's view, raises questions about whether the number of Iraqi civilians caught in the crossfire has also gone up. If these payments, these condolence payments, as some people call them, have gone up so dramatically, it begs the question, well, have the number of Iraqi deaths at the hands of U.S. troops also gone up?
Now, the military says that the payments should not be seen as admission of guilt or responsibility, and I take it that they are part of a tradition in Iraq.
Well, yes, there is a tradition there that dates back centuries, really, that when someone is wronged in one way or another by someone else, it's the responsibility of that person or their family to make restitution. You're right, the military maintains that just because we're making these payments does not mean that we're acknowledging that we were responsible or we made a mistake. But again, I think Senator Kennedy wants more answers and has asked the Government Accountability Office to look in a more detailed way into where these payments have gone and, you know, what the circumstances were.
Now, the fund used to make the payments is called the Commander's Emergency Response Program, and the money's generated from monies that are seized or captured from insurgents, I gather, as well as some contributions from the United Nations and some appropriations by Congress. What are the rules governing the compensation that's paid?
Well, you know, that's also part of the concern, which is there's not a whole lot known about how this money is tracked, who makes the decision. You know, it appears that when they set up this SERP program, as they call it, this emergency response program, they basically had the intention that a U.S. commander on the ground would have pretty wide authority to decide when that money should be doled out, whether it's to make amends to an Iraqi family for damage to their property. In some cases, in many cases, the fund has been used to just generally buy goodwill among the local population. If there's a company commander who's in a town and believes they need another well dug for drinking water or something even as basic as that that might help build goodwill, the money has gone to that. So it's part of this larger fund that's at the disposal of commanders on the ground, but it's not really clear whether there's a real good accounting, other than the aggregate amount, a real good accounting of where the money's been going.
So it may be very difficult then to answer the question raised by Senator Kennedy, have in fact the casualties gone up?
Well, I mean, not necessarily. I mean, obviously, for example, the Marines operating in Al-Anbar province, where it appears that much of this increase has been seen, where some of the most violence has been occurring in some of the most active U.S. operations, the Marines keep records of incidents that may have occurred in which there were casualties, which there were innocent Iraqis that were injured or killed. So, you know, it won't be easy, but certainly there's going to be some record of where these units were, what they did, when, you know, during the time period that this money was handed out. So they should be able to find some answers. If indeed, you know, if the military authorities in Iraq and in the Pentagon, you know, provide some of that background.
Are they looking? Is anybody trying to figure out whether there's a pattern here and if, in fact, civilian casualties have risen?
Well, that seems to be the intent of Senator Kennedy's request to the Government Accountability Office to look at that very issue. And, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see. It'll probably take some time and some effort to really come to any real conclusions, but they should be able to provide at least a little bit more light on why these payments to Iraqis have gone up for these condolence payments and why they've gone up so dramatically. You know, I think it's important to note, too, that from what I'm told, there are other funds, other pots of money, if you will, that also are spent on similar activities. So it's not just this Commander's Emergency Response Program. There are other funds out there that have been dispersed as well. And, you know, I think it's like a lot of spending, a lot of resources that have gone to this war. It seems the longer the war goes on, the more the budgets grow, the harder and harder it is to kind of keep track of where all the money's gone.
Brian Bender, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure.
National security reporter for the Boston Globe. Tony Perry is San Diego bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, spends a lot of time at Camp Pendleton, has in fact been also an embedded reporter during the war in Iraq, during the invasion itself. Tony Perry, you reported the other day, as did many others, on the charges against U.S. Marines for premeditated murder. Do you see a relationship here, and do you think that there are, in fact, there has been an increase in civilian casualties?
I think there probably has. Remember, you have to keep in mind that the U.S. and its coalition partners are fighting an enemy that likes to hide among women and children. That's the nature of an insurgency, and anytime you have that kind of fight, you're going to have innocent death, and I think we've seen that. So I would not at all be surprised, and certainly those payments that your previous guest was talking about, they've gone up pretty dramatically, and that's a sign right there.
What about the attitude of the ground troops with regard to the standards that are used to determine when a civilian casualty is acceptable and when it isn't? What sorts of issues are they wrangling with right now?
Well, they're wrangling with the practical ones. How much force is justifiable? How much force is justifiable? Not when you're in a firefight, but when you're trying to get information about the IED, the roadside bomb that just blew up and killed your buddy, or the one that might be being planted in the next few hours that will blow up underneath your convoy. That is the devilishly difficult thing. In a firefight, that's one kind of judgment that has to be made. But how tough can you get on the spot, in the home, in the marketplace, in the field with someone that you know in your gut has information. That's a very difficult call.
And Marines have been charged with premeditated murder in Hamandiya. There's some indication that in the Haditha incident they may be charged as well. So I would assume that there's more conversation than ever among the Marines about these issues.
Sure, and I'll admit my experience has been with ground forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. I've not spent a lot of time with the air power wing of the Marine Corps or the military. So I guess my viewpoint is informed by who the folks I've been with, and you will hear at the lower levels among, you know, squad leaders and such discussion about whether there's one set of rules for ground pounders and another for those that drop bombs or shoot rockets from a long way away. Are we more forgiving when things go errant when it's air power than when it's a 19-year-old with an M16? That's sort of, you know, barracks chatter, if you will, but it's out there, and they are concerned. And I think the whole Marine Corps, two-thirds of whom is on its first enlistment, right, and is 22 or younger, I think the whole Marine Corps is watching what's going to happen both in the Hamandiya case and the Haditha case, where we've had 24 Iraqis dead and we're pending charges there. The whole Marine Corps is watching this case.
Well, is the whole Marine Corps also watching to see whether or not a pilot might in fact be charged? Has this ever happened in a case where there was collateral damage, so-called?
I haven't seen it happen with a U.S. Pilot or artillery officer or someone. That's what I'm talking about, that there seems to be some indication and some feeling among the ground pounders, among the enlisted in particular, that we're evolving two sets of standards, one much more rigorous for people who go out and drive in Humvees and have to confront people, and a softer standard, if you will, from people who shoot artillery or people who drop bombs or people who launch missiles for some period. Now, I don't know any study that suggests that. I don't know any academic that has looked at this. I'm talking about what corporals and sergeants are talking about as they sit around deciding whether to go out now or in an hour on their next mission.
Tony Perry, San Diego bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Are there class differences and differences in background between the people you refer to as the ground pounders and the people up there in the air flying the planes?
Oh, absolutely. People without a draft for the last 30 years, the American public, American political class for that matter, has really lost touch with what the American military looks like. And one thing I think has happened is we all have decided that they're an undifferentiated mass from the Marine Corps on one end to the National Guard on the other. Well, they're not. And they're quite different, and each service is different. Each, what they call community within the service, is different. You would never mistake infantry troops in the Marines for fighter pilots among the Navy. They come from different backgrounds. Their education is different. Their mindsets are different. They're all, you know, brothers in the uniform, et cetera, but they're quite a bit different. And I think that's one of these things that we've kind of lost when we really don't know, now that we've sort of outsourced our fighting and dying force. We've kind of forgotten the individual characteristics of each fighting force.
So does that fuel then, do you think, what I believe you were implying is resentment on the part of the ground pounders over what they think may be different standards with regard to this issue of civilian casualties?
Absolutely. Again, we were talking at the level of sort of barracks chatter, but you will hear people say, now why is it that we are so worried about the lives of pilots that we will invest millions, billions, developing drones, these pilotless vehicles to go do this, that, and the other, for fear we might lose a pilot in the process, but we will send a squad of Marines into a building where we know very well that there are insurgents with AK-47s and booby traps and such. Why is it the American military, American public, is so concerned about one class of folk and less so, it appears, to the enlisted, about another?
Sure.
Now, it fuels their idea that they're the real machos, of course, and it reinforces their culture, but it's out there, an idea that when it comes to the ground troops, there is less concern about their lives than maybe there are about people who went to college and became pilots.
Tony Perry, again, with the Los Angeles Times, San Diego bureau chief. Professor Scott Silliman is a professor of law at Duke University. He's executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke. For 25 years, he worked as an attorney in the United States Air Force. Professor, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Warren.
What about this distinction between the casualties that occur as a result of bombs dropped from the air presuming that it can be known in advance that that's going to happen, and the casualties that occur that we're talking about now that people are actually being prosecuted for?
Well, Warren, the standard's the same. Obviously, the execution of that standard on the ground is different than in the air. But the Department of Defense, whether you're talking about the Marine Corps, the Air Force, the Army, are all bound by what we call international humanitarian law. And the standard is very clear, and all the troops are trained in it, that you can never prevent civilian damage or civilian deaths. But you cannot attack if the level of civilian damage or death is excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated. Let me give you an example. If an Air Force pilot, as we've seen in Zakari's situation, is targeting Osama bin Laden, and the only way that Osama bin Laden could be killed would result in perhaps 50 or 60 Iraqi civilian deaths or Pakistani deaths, then the value of Osama bin Laden as a military target is so great that you could normally expect a greater amount of civilian damage. But if you're going after a Taliban soldier, then you must have a much lesser amount of civilian damage that's acceptable. And this is a matter of law. It's a law that is given in briefings to everyone on an annual basis. So as far as the legal perspective, there is no difference between any of the services.
Who determines the value of the target? It would seem to me it would be very different if you were an American officer deciding whether to hit a bomb, to hit Osama bin Laden with a bomb, or you were somebody who happened to live in the village where Osama bin Laden was hiding out.
Well, this is a decision that's made by leadership. It may be a senior sergeant. It may be a young officer. It may be a senior general officer. It all depends on the situation. With regard to the Air Force, they normally know from an intelligence perspective what they're going after, whereas a Marine patrol is going to walk into something, they have to make a decision. That's where their training comes in, Warren. That's where their training and the application of law and targeting comes in. Now, also, I think your listeners need to know that military attorneys are heavily involved in a lot of these decisions. Attorneys help the targeting commander make that decision on the type of munitions that should be used, the angle of attack, all with a view towards minimizing civilian deaths. You can never avoid it, but the law requires us to minimize it.
Can you understand, particularly given what we heard from Tony Perry about the class differences between the ground pounders and the guys up there in the air, that there might be some resentment on the part of people on the ground and that there might be a suspicion that some people are, you know, getting more attention, more protection than others?
Well, I understand what Tony's hearing from those with whom he's talking. But again, I think when you're talking about the incidents at Haditha or El Hamadaniyah, as I understand the allegations, Warren, these are situations where you weren't dealing with civilians that were caught in a firefight. These situations at least allegedly involve Marines that went after and specifically targeted civilians. They were not combatants. That's a big difference from what we're talking about.
John Sifton, Scott Sullivan, a professor at Duke University. We'll be back with John Sifton. We'll tell you who he is in a moment. We're going to take a very brief break on Reporter's Notebook later. What happened to the bipartisan reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about civilian casualties during wartime, specifically, of course, in the war in Iraq, and whether there is a different standard used as far as the enforcement of international law is concerned when it comes to people who are on the ground, the ground pounders, as Tony Perry, the Los Angeles Times called them, and the pilots who are high up in the air and responsible for collateral damage and cause civilian casualties that way. Professor Scott Silliman of Duke University has just said that the standard actually is the same and set by international law. John Sifton is a senior researcher on terrorism and counterterrorism at Human Rights Watch. He previously was a researcher on the ground in Afghanistan, and he helped carry out a battle damage assessment there. He joins us now from New York. John Sifton, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you think?
Well, there's a distinction. It's certainly a different situation to be on the ground than to be flying so high in the air. But Scott Silliman is correct that you cannot in any circumstance intentionally target civilians.
the issue here is about making mistakes and whether you accidentally kill civilians or whether you inevitably kill civilians while seeking to hit a legitimate military target. That's the big question.
Sure. Do you think that the pilots in the air are given more leeway when it comes to determining whether the collateral damage, as it's always called, is accidental or, as you put it, inevitable?
Well, the pilots are very rarely put in a situation where they are the ones making the decisions. Advanced planning for airstrikes are quite normal. Now, we do have some concerns with what they call emerging targets. At the beginning of the Second Gulf War, there were some 50 high-value target situations where very quickly, with sort of questionable intelligence, the U.S. military carried out airstrikes on targets where they thought Saddam Hussein and his sons and several other high-level officials were supposed to be around Baghdad and other locations. They went 0 for 50 in those 50 strikes. They didn't kill a single high-value target, but they killed a large number of civilians. And we looked at that because we were very concerned and found that the fact of the matter was the intelligence that was being gathered very quickly on the ground by paid Iraqi informants. It was in many cases erroneous. In addition, the coordinates that were being called in on Thuraya satellite telephones, which have a give or take of 10 meters on the coordinate system that they have, a GPS coordinate system. So you had this situation where a paid Iraqi informant would be calling in questionable intelligence, resulting in questionable coordinates, which were then used, transmitted to pilots who had no idea what they were hitting. They launched the bomb. They killed some civilians. It's really not entirely their fault, but it's an institutional problem that we approached the Air Force to complain about.
Was there ever anybody brought to account for any of these civilian casualties under those circumstances? And if not, should there have been?
Well, in a situation like that, it's pretty hard to call it a war crime. It's more like us saying, look, you guys have a really bad way of doing this. You got to change it. There have been other circumstances.
Well, excuse me. Why is it hard to call it a war crime?
Because a war crime typically is where you either intentionally target civilians or you are completely reckless and you use indiscriminate means while targeting targeting military targets, or you just don't make any effort to distinguish between military targets and civilians. You just sort of fire wildly, you know, at the enemy and don't make any effort to distinguish. Those are the sorts of things that are war crimes. And in this, it was a situation where they were attempting to hit some very high-value targets, and they were going about it in a very stupid way. And that stupidity can be complained about and criticized, but it would be hard-pressed to actually prosecute somebody and say somebody should be prosecuted for that, although it's incredibly lamentable. And that brings us to what Tony Perry was talking about, which is, you know, is there a higher standard in practice? Obviously, the standards are the same for everybody on the ground and in the air, as Professor Silliman said, but in practice, is it the case that perhaps the microscope is a little bit more focused on ground troops than on the Air Force?
And you're saying it is?
Well, to some degree it is, and to some degree it isn't. And what I mean is, in some cases, the Air Force and the Navy, who also fly missions, if you go to them, they, of course, say, no, you know, it's us who get criticized. We're the ones who get criticized every time there's an airstrike. And meanwhile, the guys on the ground, you know, can get away with anything. And then everybody's always complaining in the military. Everybody, each service complains about the other service. It's like it's the one tradition that's carried through the military, complaining about each other. So I think everybody's got some valid complaints here. But it is true that there have been very few criminal investigations of air pilots and people making decisions about airstrikes. And that's a big problem. Afghanistan, where there are fewer ground troops but more airstrikes, has a lot of civilian casualties, and it doesn't get a lot of attention. The fact of the matter is, over the last 3 months, there have been twice as many airstrikes carried out by pilots in Afghanistan as in Iraq. Twice as many. So it's kind of a reversal there. You have fewer ground troops but more airstrikes, and there's more civilian casualties due to airstrikes than there are in Iraq.
All right. Understand. John Sifton, again, a senior researcher on terrorism and counterterrorism at Human Rights Watch. Let me go back to Professor Silliman at Duke University. Before we get to the question of Afghanistan, here's a situation early in the war where John Sifton says that the intelligence wasn't all that good, that it came from paid informants, that they weren't all that accurate in showing people exactly where the targets were going to be. According to him, they were 0 for 50 in hitting the high-value targets, Saddam Hussein and his sons. At what point do you decide that they're being reckless?
Well, it's an excellent question, Warren, again, and I think John indicated. The problem is intelligence. How do you verify the intelligence which is then used in a targeting decision? And again, I want to stress that you've got military lawyers trained in the law of war assisting the commander in making these decisions on targeting specific military objectives.
Where are the lawyers? Are they out there in the field?
They are in Combat Operations Center, which are in constant contact with the aircrews. On constant contract. Now, John mentioned this question of emerging targets. I want to stress, those are very, very few instances where bombs are dropped on emerging targets. Just about every mission is pre-briefed, pre-planned, with regard to the type of munition to be used, how it's going to be dropped, the angle of attack, and all that is done in compliance with the law. That's one of the reasons why, although you've got perhaps more civilians killed, as John mentioned, in Afghanistan, that's a problem to deal with, but it doesn't mean there are any war crimes being committed, nor does it mean that we're violating the law. It just means that there was a high-value target, and civilians were in that direct area, and unfortunately, that's what we call collateral damage. But the law allows for that type of killing.
If, in fact, there are more, twice as many airstrikes going on in Afghanistan as there are in Iraq, would you suggest, given the possibility for error, even with the lawyers on the case, that ought to be more carefully examined than it is, or do you think that it is being carefully examined?
Well, I think it is, Warren, and I think, again, the point is, if we're getting faulty intelligence, and this country has had to deal with this issue of faulty intelligence going all the way back to the invasion of Iraq, that's something that has to be dealt with, but that's not going to be the fault of that young Marine on the ground at Haditha, or it's not going to be the problem for the pilot to deal with. That's a senior-level issue to be dealt with by the United States government and how it vets the intelligence and how credible that intelligence is. It's a problem, but it's not one for that young soldier or airman to deal with.
Scott Tilleman, once again, former attorney during the in the Air Force and now a professor at Duke University School of Law. John Sifton, back to you with Human Rights Watch. You said you complained to the military authorities about the situation with regard to the collateral damage from overhead from bombs coming out of the air. What sort of response did you get?
Well, there was a lot of agreement on a lot of things. As Professor Silliman said, most targets are pre-planned, and these attacks about emerging targets where decisions were made on the fly were the exception, not the rule. But the fact of the matter is that the pre-planned targets didn't cause that many civilian casualties. It was these on-the-fly decisions that actually caused the most problems on the ground. But, you know, it's quite amazing how much leeway, how much they do listen to us. We complained after the Kosovo conflict about the use of certain cluster munitions. We saw the Air Force change its rules for using cluster munitions. These are bombs which are dropped out of an airplane and then sort of unravel and become a lot of little bombs mm-hmm. that are spread over an area. They're not supposed to be used in civilian areas. They're more for, you know, deserts and mountaintops and things like that where there are not that many civilians. We complained about it, and the Air Force has lowered the amount they use it and lowered the amounts of context in which they use those weapons. We still had some problems, however, because the Army was continuing to use artillery cluster munitions, and we complained about that, and I think they listened to us. So, I mean, it's a process. It's a give and take. We talk about our concerns. They listen, and they may make changes, or they might not. As far as this emerging target thing, it's a big problem. And, in fact, the only airmen who have been charged for anything, really, are some people who killed some Canadian troops in Afghanistan near Kandahar. They accidentally killed some Canadian troops in a friendly fire incident, and they were, in fact, court-martialed for that incident. So it's not as though this thing doesn't occur, that people are held accountable for mistakes they make in the air. It does occur. It just doesn't occur as much as it does with troops on the ground. And that's, I think, what Tony Perry is saying has some truth to it. But I wouldn't go too far. I mean, the guys on the ground, you know, they get away with a lot, too. They get away with a lot.
John Sifton, again, at Human Rights Watch. Our next guest can talk about this from two points of view, one as a former combat, as a combat veteran, and a decorated one as well in Vietnam, and also as a very high-level military person. He was former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He's Wade Sanders, now a business attorney who practices in San Diego. And, Mr. Sanders, thank you a lot for joining us.
Yes, good afternoon, Warren.
First, from the standpoint of the highest levels of the military, how do you go about to making the kinds of distinctions and the kinds of calls that we're talking about here? How much time and attention is being paid to it?
Well, a tremendous amount of attention is being paid to it, of course, and obviously the military doesn't go out of its way to kill innocent civilians, but I think it's important to point out that we're dealing with, you know, the classic difference between total war, as in the Second World War, when we deliberately bombed civilians, as we did in Japan with firebombing and what we did in Cologne and Dresden and other major cities in Germany, where we deliberately were consciously and deliberately targeting and taking out civilian population bases as terror bombing, and an insurgency where you do not assume that everybody is classically an opponent, as we did with Germany and Japan. And when you're dealing in an insurgency, of course, you have a far more complex situation. But I would propose that if you happen to be an Iraqi family who's just had their other family wiped out as a result of collateral damage, these kinds of dancing on the pin legal distinctions are important to those people who make the decisions, but not very important to the people on the field who have suffered a loss of life. But I will restate that, of course, when I was in the Secretariat, I didn't have to make these kinds of decisions. I was oversight for the entire Navy and Marine Corps Reserve. But as a serving soldier, serving combat veteran on the ground, of course we were concerned about that in Vietnam, and that is trying to distinguish between killing innocent, well, unarmed, let's put it that way. Unarmed, our rules of engagement were very clear about the difference between unarmed individuals and armed individuals.
Okay, so you could make that kind of distinction, obviously, by looking at somebody, then, I would assume. Back to this issue of the terror bombing, I'm just it's obviously incidental to this conversation in a way, but how does that stack up now in the rules of war that have been established? Have they been changed since World War II? Is it permissible to do that?
Well, a determination was made about the time of the Nuremberg trials. There was some outcry from people that the 8th Air Force, in particular, in Europe, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the number of the Air Force that was in the Pacific Theater, but there was some outcry from the public about these types of, and there was a lot of moral questioning and debate and dialogue about this very issue about, you know, when is it permissible to strike at civilian population centers as opposed to hard. Industrial targets or military targets. And, I'm not, quite frankly, I cannot speak to the idea of whether the rules were different then or if they've changed since then, but I know that contemporarily, and in Vietnam and today in Iraq and Afghanistan and also in Kosovo and the former Yugoslavia, that every effort was made not to deliberately bomb civilian population centers or civilian targets.
Okay. Now, of course, we have the Geneva Conventions, which were, in fact, a product of World War II. Let me get back to the question of the people on the ground. We have now seen Marines being charged with premeditated murder in at least one case, and there's a possibility that other charges may arise from at least one more case as well. Mr. Sanders, what do you think about the condition of the Marines at this point, the kinds of pressures that they're facing in Iraq?
Well, I was in Yuma last week, and I happened to cross the street from where I was to a watering hole, and I bought two pitchers of beer for 12 Marines who had just returned, and they were on their finished up their second rotation. And I can speak personally from the pressures that combat brings to bear, and I can speak personally to the types of tensions that one builds up inside oneself when one is taken to the edge of killing repetitively. And I did it for a year. That was the standard tour. I think what we saw in Haditha, what we may have seen in Haditha, I think more classically than what we saw with the more recent incident, or not more recent, but at least the more recent individuals who were charged, is that the Haditha incident could arguably be not in cold blood, but in hot passion. I mean, they were reacting to a particular situation which triggered all these tensions to explode and let loose, whereas the premeditation aspect is an entirely different story. But I would contend that they all fall within as I learned from these Marines, is that we may be reaching the breaking point is how many times you can send somebody into a counterinsurgency situation where they never know who's going to kill them. How long can you put somebody up with that? And when I asked these Marines, I knew the answer to this question. I knew that the Marine Corps, the Army, have conscientiously tried to set up counseling centers and provide relief and instruction to leadership to be able to recognize the symptomology of when somebody's going to break. But what they told me was, and it's not surprising, you know, they're young men, they're warriors. They say, well, we don't go there because either it might, they believe it might, and that might be not correct, but they believe that if they present themselves for counseling or therapy, that somebody will think that that might affect their career, or it's an indication of their own personal weakness. So we really still have to get our arms around, right, the whole issue of how you deal with the kind of pressures that build up with somebody when you give them license to kill and you take them into situations where they have to face that on a daily basis.
Let me go back to Professor Scott Silliman. We've been talking to Wade Sanders, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy. This distinction was made between hot passion and cold blood. In Hamdaniya, the accusation is premeditated murder. In Haditha, the reports, we have not seen accusations as yet, have been, as the former secretary suggested, that there was a retaliation aspect to this because an IED had gone off and killed people's comrades. Is that something, is that a distinction you can make in a military court?
Yes, you can, Warren, and I think that's exactly the point why we haven't had charges actually preferred in the Haditha incident, which goes all the way back to November, and yet we have had charges already preferred in Hamdaniya, simply because that appeared to be an execution type of killing. The law takes into consideration what we call the fog of war, confusion, and that's not normally going to result in any kind of criminal charges. What's troubling about the Haditha incident is something that goes back to your first guest. The payment of up to $38,000 in Salatian payments, which are normally only paid out when the United States government has, for some reason or the other, caused the death or the injury to an innocent person. That's in conflict with the original story that the Marines put out that said that those Iraqis were killed in a firefight or in a blast. So it's the different stories that's causing the criminal investigation that's looking very hard at that incident. But again, there is going to be confusion on the battlefield. That's always going to be taken into account. Criminal charges are only going to result after a very careful investigation indicating that something way beyond the bounds of normal training and discipline occurred.
All right. That is all the time we have for an extraordinarily important conversation. I want to thank all of you for participating in it. To Professor Scott Silliman, whom we just heard, at Duke University, formerly an attorney in the United States Air Force. Wade Sanders, former Deputy Assistant Secretary to the Navy, combat veteran, decorated in Vietnam. John Sifton of Human Rights Watch. Tony Parry with the Los Angeles Times. And our earlier guest, Brian Bender, with the Boston Globe. Thank you all very much for being with us. The Voting Rights Act was signed by Lyndon Johnson in 1965, and it's widely credited with making blacks in southern states part of the political process. Some provisions will expire next year, and last month, House and Senate leaders of both parties appeared on the Capitol steps to endorse the extension of those provisions for 25 years. But on Wednesday, the House Republicans pulled back because some members claim the act is unfair. In a moment, more on one of the major fixtures of the civil rights movement on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at kcrw.com, keyword To the Point. You can also podcast the show at kcrw.com.
Mormon Olney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. Some Democrats are said to be holding their fire on the delay at extending the Voting Rights Act in hopes of restoring last month's bipartisan agreement. But the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, Democrat Melvin Watt of North Carolina, says he thinks opponents want to use the extra time to further politicize the issue. One of the Republican congressmen who held up extension is Lynn Westmoreland of Georgia. Tom Baxter is chief political correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tom Baxter, good to have you with us.
Good to be there.
Tell us a bit, if you will, about both Lynn Westmoreland and his constituents.
Well, Lynn Westmoreland is a conservative Republican congressman, comes out of our state legislature. He's in a lot of ways a child of what is often called white flight. His family, I believe that Congressman Westmoreland's father was at one time a fireman here in Atlanta, and part of that great wave of mostly white working class Atlantans who moved into the South Metro area, the southern suburbs of the city.
Moved for what purpose?
Well, for a lot of reasons, perhaps, but in the wake of integration in the 1960s and 70s.
So, what about his constituents then? I take it they're a similar kind of people.
I would stop you right there.
Sure.
There's no more diverse an area than metro suburban Atlanta. I mean, there are people, there are kinds of people there, I guess, who people who were originally residents of one part of town and moved to another. But they're very often living next door to people from South Asia or from New Jersey. So it's not the kind of place that's in any way homogeneous.
Well, thanks for that. I need a little more education about Atlanta. But the question was this. Why is it that Lynn Westmoreland would choose to hold up the Voting Rights Act? And is it something that he thinks is going to appeal to his constituents? Are they, in fact, eager to see the end of the Voting Rights Act?
I think that the terms of the Voting Rights Act itself have become so established over 41 years that people don't really feel very strongly about that. But what is at issue is what is called Section 5. And as you know, those states which were ruled to have had a background of discrimination in 1965 were subject to special requirements for preclearance, not only of redistricting changes, big changes like the changing the congressional map after the census every year, but moving a precinct location across the street requires U.S. Department of Justice approval. And so those states which are under, and there's some states where localities and counties are under Section 5 requirements, have always chafed at those extra requirements and wondered aloud whether politics has evolved, they're any more guilty of discrimination than any other locality or locality next door.
Is there also, are the congressmen and others defensive about changes that have taken place in Georgia law and since 1965?
Are they defensive about?
Yeah, are they, in other words, have there been changes in both law and practice that they feel have them now in conformity with federal law so that
yes.
they don't have to be subject to these special requirements?
Yes. In fact, when the law was written in 1965, there was a rather simple formula that was given for which states would have to comply with Section 5. One part of that was whether a state had any test or devices like the poll tax, which were consciously intended to retard voter participation. The other test was whether in the last presidential election, which was 1964, whether the state had less than 50% of the voting age population voting in that election. For either one of those reasons, you could come under Section 5.
Mm-hmm.
And what Westmoreland is proposing is that instead of the 1964 presidential election, the Justice Department use the last three presidential elections, which would create a much different list. Georgia would be on the list, but the other southern states, including Alabama and Mississippi, would not. They've not had an election, a presidential election in the last three where their voter participation has slipped below 50%. However, Hawaii, California, and Nevada have, and mm-hmm. they would be added to the list.
So there obviously are a lot of aspects to all of this. Do you think, as Melvin Watt of North Carolina, the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, thinks, that over time Mr. Westmoreland and others will be able to get some changes introduced?
I'm not sure, because at the beginning of this week, I think Representative Westmoreland was carrying this amendment of his more or less as a sort of a general protest with no realistic expectation that he could get it passed. By Wednesday, when the Republican leadership pulled back on the bill, there were enough objections coming from other quarters and over other issues in the Voting Rights Act that I think it has emboldened some of those critics of the Voting Rights Act to think that perhaps they could get much greater changes than they thought they were going to get a month ago when those unified leadership, as you mentioned before, stood on the Capitol steps and said that this was a done deal.
All right. Well, we will follow this, of course. July recess is coming up. There may be some time before this is, in fact, reintroduced. And Tom Baxter, thanks a lot for the background.
You're quite welcome.
Chief political correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Daniel Konecki, and Jonah King. Our managing producer is Karen Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com, and the key word is To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI. Public Radio International.